You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin Democratic congressman about why he's holding a town hall meeting in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The biggest story of the week was the president's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. There was a lot of reaction from lawmakers, journalists, and one Wisconsin congressman in particular.
First-term Republican Representative Mike Gallagher shared his reaction on Twitter. Robert Mentzer joins us now for a look at that and other top news stories from around Wisconsin. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He is based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hello. Happy Friday.
Well, James Comey firing shook things up around the country and here in Wisconsin, too. People from around the congressional delegation have been reacting to this.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, I don't need to tell WPR listeners, this is kind of a big story, this FBI firing thing. So it's the sort of thing that you might expect your representatives in Washington to have some opinions about, and it turns out that many of them do, although some don't, at least judging by public statements this week. But probably the most notable was Representative Mike Gallagher, the Republican from Green Bay. He is a freshman member of Congress, and he went farther. I think he went further than most Republicans did in the type of language that he used in his reaction. He had a sort of a tweet storm on Wednesday morning. He said that it was quote imperative that both congressional and FBI investigations into Russian interference in our country continue unimpeded and unaltered. He wrote that, quote, we must ruthlessly pursue the truth wherever it may lead. And so, you know, this was newsworthy, not just because, I mean, anyone's reaction is newsworthy. What the Republican Congress is going to do in the wake of the firing is certainly newsworthy. But it was worthwhile because it was against a backdrop of a whole lot of Republican statements that were either neutral or supportive of the firing. So Gallagher sort of stood out in that way.
And as I understand it, I didn't go back and investigate this. I understand Congressman Gallagher's Twitter feed had been not widely used and not really tackling controversial stuff up to this point. So this was kind of out of character from his limited time in Congress so far.
That's right. And you know, so he's a former Marine. He served in Iraq, and so he has an interest in national security issues. So this may be one reason why this resonated with him. But yeah, you know, especially as a freshman from a, you know, his race was not close. So, you know, you might expect that, that he would lay low a little bit. Much more veteran Congressman Sean Duffy from the 7th District has not said a word about the firing of Comey in public anywhere, as best as we can tell. So Gallagher sort of put himself out there.
Let me throw a little sidebar at you, Rob. Are we seeing more and more legislators and others in government weighing in on Twitter? I mean, obviously the president, that's his favorite medium, but is this a growing trend?
Well, so, you know, I mean, the thing about Twitter is, for one thing, every reporter uses it obsessively, so it's a simple way to communicate with the media if you're a public official. And of course it has the virtue, if you're a public official, of you don't have to take follow-up questions. Now Gallagher, to his credit, Gallagher went on some local TV in the Green Bay area, so that's not completely fair in this specific case, but as a broad matter, it's probably simpler to put your message out on Twitter and sort of, you know, you can edit it and figure out exactly what you want to say and not have to deal with pesky journalists like us who want to sort of pin you down. Mike Gallagher, are you calling for a special prosecutor or an independent investigation or what?
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. So a new report came out this week, Rob, on how Wisconsin's voter ID law and some other election changes might have affected the presidential election and voter turnout in 2016. What did the report say?
So this story in The Nation magazine starts off with a pretty compelling anecdote. There was a 58-year-old African-American man in Milwaukee named Eddie Holloway Jr., whose birth certificate, in error, said that his name was Eddie Jr. Holloway. And according to this report, that guy made 7 trips to the DMV and other public agencies. He went back and forth to his home in Illinois and back to Milwaukee. He spent $200 to try to get the birth certificate corrected, but he couldn't. And as a result, he never got to vote in Wisconsin in the 2016 presidential election. So that is the anecdote. The broader claim is that this study tried to look at how broadly voter ID laws may have depressed turnout, especially among African Americans, who all the data shows are less likely to have a valid state ID. There are some reasons to be cautious about the conclusion, which was that the conclusion was that the voter ID law in Wisconsin may have reduced turnout by as much as 200,000 votes. It's good to take that with a bit of a grain of salt. The study itself was done by Priorities USA, a progressive advocacy group with the express partisan goal of helping Democrats win elections, and it sought to compare voter turnout in states like Wisconsin with states that didn't adopt voter ID laws between 2012 and 2016. But it's just very hard to identify, to isolate the other factors that may have led and did lead some voters to stay home in 2016 specifically. So being cautious here, nevertheless, it's an interesting study. It looks at, it raises some interesting points. One, it looks at turnout in African American counties, counties with a majority African American population or large African American population in Wisconsin compared to Minnesota, and finds a sharper decline in Wisconsin, and there's no obvious reason why that would be. It argues that voter ID may have contributed.
We'll be talking, by the way, to Ari Berman from The Nation on Central Time Monday after 3:30, looking at voter ID laws. And he makes the case that they amount to voter suppression. We'll hear what he has to say then. Rob, I want to move on to another story, kind of an inspiring one here. The Children's Hospital of Wisconsin saved the life of a young bonobo, who's a kind of monkey, named Noel. Tell us that story.
Rob, a bonobo is an ape. There's no tail on a bonobo.
Oh, okay. I put you to the test, Rob, and you passed with flying colors.
You're not the first. In fact, the story said there was they paged the doctor saying sick monkey. So this is great. I mean, this, you got to love this story. This is Noel, the 3-year-old bonobo chimpanzee from the Milwaukee County Zoo, who is doing fine, by the way. But in November, was treated in a pediatric critical care unit at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. And this week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel pulled this story and published photos of Noel. And I think it's important that any listener who is not currently driving should Google bonobo saved at Children's Hospital or whatever, and just enjoy the photos of a 3-year-old baby Noel. They're great.
And this isn't standard operating procedure for a children's hospital. Did it take a little, extra figuring out, extrapolating, and trial and error to do this?
So I think that this is the case, right? This wasn't their first move wasn't to call Children's Hospital. They realized that Noel's respiratory problems required certain equipment. But it truly is fascinating. These bonobos share 98% of genetic materials with humans, and this story does contain these lines, which are just lovely. Which is, treating a sick 3-year-old bonobo is not much different than treating a sick 3-year-old child. They're just hairier.
Words we can all live by. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to round up some of the top state news from the last week. Constituent town hall meetings have become more contentious lately as national lawmakers return home to advocate for or against policies being voted on in Washington, D.C. Republicans have been on the receiving end of much of the frustration this time around, and some of them have opted to not hold town hall meetings.
Because of this, some Democratic members of Congress have decided to hold town hall meetings in their Republican colleagues' districts.
Representative Mark Pocan joins us now. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd congressional district, which includes Madison. He held a town hall-style meeting today in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district. Representative Pocan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, why did you have an event in your neighbor's district?
Well, you know, I understand people don't like to go to a town hall when people, you know, disagree with them. But, you know, we've got some really big issues facing this country. And part of our job as elected representatives is to talk to the people who hire us, which is our constituents. And what we saw was after the healthcare vote last week, 217 people voted for the bill, and less than 20 of them had a town hall this week to try to explain that and other things. So because of that, you know, you can't just hide from your constituents. I was invited by a group board, Kenosha, to come down there, and I thought it would be a good idea, since Paul Ryan was the author of that bill, to really explain it to people.
And what was your response? Again, a sympathetic organization, I would imagine, hosting this event, but what kind of response did you get from people in that district?
Well, you know, again, one of the reasons you do town halls is to have those personal conversations. And there are people sharing their stories about pre-existing conditions and, you know, a child who has a health ailment that they're afraid could lose coverage, or losing a lifetime, you know, having a lifetime cap on coverage could affect them negatively. And, you know, just listening to people so that you know how to craft the best legislation is what your job is. And, you know, the fact that the Republicans rushed this terrible bill together without waiting for a CBO score, without really knowing the full ramifications, you know, made it that someone had to be down there to provide some of those answers. And, you know, I think that this is something we need to do in more districts. It's not just this. It's, you know, Russian interference with our elections. It's, you know, the banning of some people coming into this country. There's a lot of issues that people aren't responding to their constituents on, and it's just not right. And I think, you know, some of us need to go into those districts then and provide answers.
Hostile questions, negative questions, challenging questions would be one thing. Some Republicans have come to these, and there have been pretty tough crowds, angry, hostile, talking over the representative. I mean, do we get to a point sometimes where it's not productive to have that if people are going to organize an effort to just to shout down the representative?
Yeah, you'd be surprised how much the crowd themselves helped to self-police that. You know, I had a couple at a town hall I had this week that, you know, didn't agree with me on the health care, and they were vocal, and I made sure they were heard. And, you know, that's the way you do it. You can't be afraid of the people who hire you. If you do, maybe you should find a different job. So, you know, I felt that it was important to get down there and try to send a message that people don't need to be afraid of their constituents. You know, people don't agree with you on everything, but it's, I think, incredibly disrespectful to ignore the people who live in your district. And I was just down there trying to help provide that message.
Did you get the sense that there were Republicans, that there were supporters of the House Republican health care plan at this event?
You know, I couldn't really tell if there were supporters of it. I mean, by the questions, you know, we went to a number of different subjects. Clearly, I think what I've heard in my district, and quite honestly, yesterday I was up in the Fox Valley in the Green Bay area with Mike Gallagher, a Republican, where we were doing joint events together. You know, you hear people have a lot of anxiety. So I think it's just important that people talk to their constituents, because how can you actually represent them if you don't listen to them? And, you know, I think sometimes people get a little lost inside the Beltway. They hang around Washington too much, or around people who fund campaigns. And, you know, the single most important thing we can do is listen to the people who elect us.
I was going to ask about that idea of a Democrat and Republican getting together in kind of a buddy system. What was that like to be up there with Representative Gallagher?
You know, it was great, because we don't agree on every issue. But what you try to do is find out what you have in common. You work off of that first. And then maybe you can figure out the things you don't have in common from there. But you start from a fundamental place of being able to do that. And I give, you know, Mike Gallagher credit that we did this joint appearance in Appleton. And, you know, he had some tough questions. We both answered them together, offered our perspective. And, you know, I think that's the kind of dialogue that is worthy of the jobs that we have. But the bottom line is we do have to talk to our constituents. And unfortunately, way too many people after that healthcare vote decided to hide and not talk to the people who actually elect them.
And looking at that healthcare plan, what is it? Obviously, you're opposed to it in its current form. What would you like to see change?
Well, I mean, their bill is really awful on multiple fronts. You know, according to the Congressional Budget Office, at least 24 million people could potentially lose their health insurance under their bill. It's going to make older Americans pay five times more than others, which is the wrong direction to go. It cuts $880 billion from the Medicaid program, and that affects a lot of seniors and people with disabilities and children in this state. There's a lot of provisions that are going to make it harder for people to have health care, and at the end, cost us all by having to pay more for that health care. So there's some real problems with their bill.
Republicans have raised the point that when it comes especially to the individual marketplace under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of companies have gotten out of the market in many parts of the country, leaving a few or in some cases only one option. Isn't that a serious problem that needed to be tackled?
Well, and that's why you fix what you have. What we have right now made sure that 20 million people who previously didn't have health insurance now have that, and we have some assurances that if you have a pre-existing condition, you now have access to health care, and there's not a lifetime cap if you're actually sick. But where we see things that have to be fixed, that's where we could have a public option that would provide competition in those areas. And there's other things that we could do that would not rob health care from tens of millions of people. And the fact that, you know, their bill ultimately really was more about giving tax breaks, $600 billion worth of tax breaks were in that bill, to the wealthiest Americans, to insurance companies and big pharma. And that's the problem. It wasn't about healthcare, solving a healthcare problem. It was about starting tax reform. Unfortunately, you know, 98% of Wisconsin wasn't included in that bill.
Talking to Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He's a Democrat. He held an event in Speaker Paul Ryan's district, one of a handful of Democrats around the state going to neighboring Republican districts to hold town hall meetings. Are you worried, Representative Pocan, that this is just going to be perceived as a stunt trolling the other side?
Well, you know, I hope there's a little bit of a shaming maybe involved that, you know, if you're not willing to listen to your constituents, that there is some force we can put on people. You know, I think often there's excuses. They say we do telephone town halls. You know, I used to do those. One, they're expensive. They cost the taxpayer is about $6,000. And two, you can screen questions. You don't do that when you're doing face-to-face town halls. So I think if we can make people realize that if they're not going to do them, someone else might come in their district and that might not play real well with people, then, you know, I think we actually make it a better democracy because people might then face their constituents, even the ones they disagree with, and maybe they'll learn something along the way.
Now, you've talked about working with people on the other side of the aisle. Going back to your days in the legislature, I think it was you and Robin Voss who wrote a piece before Act 10 days about trying to respect the other side and work together. Do you still hold on to hopes that you could do that at the state level or in Washington?
You know, I think within 24 hours I did both, right? The day before, I was working with a Republican member of our state delegation that wanted to do outreach and wanted to do the right thing. And then today, someone who's ignoring their constituents. So I think you can do both parts of it. But ultimately, you know, Wisconsin's a medium-sized state. We got to watch out for the whole state in addition to our district. And I grew up in Kenosha where we had that town hall. I've got family down there. I've got friends from high school and their kids and their grandkids down there. You know, it's not right that they have a representative who won't listen to them. So I had no problem with going down there and doing that, and I did it, and I think in for the most part, a respectful way. And I think that, you know, you can do that and yet still increase the dialogue and debate that needs to happen.
I want to get your thoughts in the next couple of minutes on the biggest story in the country, the firing of FBI Director James Comey and the ongoing Russia investigation. First, what was your reaction to the dismissal of the FBI director?
Well, you know, more than the dismissal was the reasons around the dismissal. I mean, finding out the White House saying one thing and then coming up with a different answer that's completely different. And at the end of the day, what it appears is the FBI is investigating the Trump White House for possible collusion with the Russians interfering with our elections. A week before, it sounds like the FBI director was asking for more money to continue this investigation. And all of a sudden, at first, we get a whole different set of reasons why. And I think we're starting to just wonder that, you know, this is perhaps obstruction of justice. This is him trying to stop himself from being investigated by the FBI director. And I think it's raised all kinds of concerns, including, by the way, from Republicans. I'm watching Republicans who've never really said much about this be pretty vocal. So, you know, I think we might be at a turning point where this White House is, you know, going to have to answer for some of their very irregular actions.
We've heard calls for an independent prosecutor, mostly from Democrats there, for a select committee in Congress from people like John McCain. Speaker Ryan has said, hey, we've got a House Intelligence Committee investigation, a Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, FBI investigation. We don't need a fourth investigation. What would you like to see happen with the investigation going forward?
Yeah, I don't want a bunch of politicians having to make these determinations. I mean, right now we've watched the dysfunction of the House Intelligence Committee because of partisanship. You know, this is something where we've got to choose country over party, and I think a special prosecutor is the best path. And honestly, if I was President Trump and I had nothing to hide, I would want a special prosecutor to get this thing out of the way so he can move ahead with his presidency. But, you know, we need to get to the bottom of it, and I think the best way to do it is to have a complete independent process, and a special prosecutor is probably the best way to do that.
If things had gone a different way and we had a President Hillary Clinton, would you have backed her firing of FBI Chief James Comey, as people thought she might do?
It all depends how she would have did it. If she would have had one set of reasons and then another set of reasons, and it turned out that the FBI director was investigating her and she just didn't like that, I probably would have been doing the exact same thing.
Representative Pocan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Mark Pocan. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He joined us today to talk about the town hall meeting he hosted in Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan's district earlier today. The United States is the developed nation with the highest rates of inequality in the world. And the inequality is on a scale we haven't seen in our lifetimes, according to our next guest. But instead of being a simple matter of how much money we make, our perception of inequality has a huge impact on how healthy we are, how likely we are to take risks, and how we think about the world around us.
Keith Payne joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's the author of the book, The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die. Keith, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, Keith, how does the U.S. stack up when it comes to different measures of inequality?
Among economically developed countries, we are the most unequal and by a large margin.
And can you define, dig in a little bit, what we mean when we use that term inequality?
So when social scientists talk about inequality, what we're really talking about is the size of the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest in society. So when people hear inequality, often they think about poverty, but it turns out that income inequality, that gap between the top and the bottom, is driven even more by the wealth of the very rich in society than by the poverty of the poor.
And you start your book with a very interesting story. It's about two separate incidents on an airplane, which becomes sort of a microcosm for what happens in society when there are big rates of inequality. Can you tell us about that, about the stories of Joseph Sharkey and Ivana Trump?
Right. So in the case of Joseph Sharkey, nobody exactly knows why he did what he did, but he stood up and started attacking the passenger behind him in coach, and the flight attendants had to restrain him. Once they did that, he tried to break away and tried to open the door of the airplane in mid-flight, and so they had to sort of pile on him and bind his hands until the plane landed, and he was charged with criminal charges. There was a case in first class with Ivana Trump a number of years ago that made a lot of headlines, in which she didn't get violent like that, but she had sort of a tantrum because some crying children wouldn't be quiet, and she had had enough of it. And from news reports, she was asked to leave the plane. And I tell those two stories because they're emblematic of scientific research that's been done that shows that in the context of airplanes, airplanes with a first-class cabin are several times more likely to have air rage incidents like that than airplanes that don't have first-class cabins. And in those that do have first-class cabins, if you board from the front and have to walk past all of the first-class section before you get to your seat, those flights have more frequent incidents of air rage than flights that board in the middle, so you don't have to walk past the first class cabin. And what those studies suggest is that airplanes are like this microcosm of inequality in our world, because even though the people in coach seats aren't poor, it costs several hundred dollars to fly, these people are mostly middle-class people. Just the presence of the first-class cabin seems to create tension, seems to create anxieties, and it ends up leading to bad behavior among both people in coach and people in first class. And I think that study's an interesting way to distill what we have going on when inequality gets very high at a national level, in a very concrete image of that airplane.
And how closely does that awareness of inequality correlate with social problems? If you're looking, for instance, at either a city or the nation as a whole, our society, problems like crime, problems like health issues and mortality, how closely does that mirror what's happening there?
There's a strong relationship between the amount of inequality, either in a country, if you're comparing across wealthy developed nations, or if you look within the United States, from one state to another. Both countries and states with higher levels of income inequality have worse outcomes on a huge range of social and health problems. So states with higher inequality have higher crime rates. They have shorter lifespans. They have higher rates of infant mortality. They have higher rates of obesity, higher rates of smoking, on and on. And these are normally problems that we think of as being associated with poverty. But among wealthy developed nations, they're actually more closely associated with inequality than with poverty.
So why is that? What's going on there?
Well, there are a number of things going on, but one of the central things that happens when inequality gets very high is that average middle-class people start feeling relatively poor by comparison. People who have enough to get by still feel left behind. You know, if you look at how income distributions have changed in America over the last 50 years or so, the bottom three-fifths of the country are essentially right where they were. If you look at income or inflation-adjusted dollars, their incomes are just about the same as they were in the 1960s. But people don't feel like they're doing just as well as they ever did. And the reason is that the top few percent have gotten much, much wealthier very fast. And by comparison to the top 5%, the top 1%, even middle-class people feel like they're being left behind.
We're talking with Keith Payne right now. He's the author of the book, The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die. And Keith, you're right about what you call a simple truth of human nature, that we crave status. Now, we don't often think we crave status when we think about our core values, status among them, but it is something you say is true. I mean, how do you see that manifesting in the way we think about ourselves when we mentally maybe place ourselves on that ladder between the people who are at the very bottom and the people who are at the very top?
Right. So, you know, talking about it in terms of status is a sort of, it's a way social scientists talk about it. It's not the way we talk about it in our daily lives, but we kind of know at a intuitive level that people care about how they're seen by other people, and people care about the kinds of goods and clothing and cars that we display to other people, right? So there's a sense in which we all kind of know that we crave status. So all that means is that we want to keep up with other people. We don't like to be on, you know, if you think about rating yourself on a ladder that has 10 rungs, are you at a 10 at the top or a 1 at the bottom? Nobody wants to be on the bottom half of that ladder. We'd all like to be on the top half, right? So even though we don't think about it as status, that's essentially what's going on whenever we try not to be left behind.
And so there's a lot that's going on in terms of our perception. Like, as you said, if we're aware, if we're walking through first class, it changes how we feel. We might feel like we're poor compared to someone else. And there's so many ways to observe wealth in our society. On TV, we could watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians. We could watch celebrity weddings. There's a number of things that could make us feel as though we're not doing so well, regardless of how much money we make. So can you tell us a little more about how that plays out and how we conduct our lives and how we think about our relationship to other people?
Right. So you were talking about the relationship between sort of what we see around us and how we feel, how wealthy or poor we feel. And the interesting thing is there's not a very strong relationship between people's actual incomes, if you just look at their dollar amounts, and how wealthy people feel. So if you ask them to rate themselves on a scale, 1 to 10 scale or whatever, the two are correlated, but not that strongly. And what that means is that there are a lot of people who rate themselves very high in subjective wealth who objectively aren't very wealthy. And there are a lot of people who rate themselves very low in subjective wealth, and objectively they're doing quite well. And if you look at how those different metrics, either people's actual incomes or how they feel about their incomes, if you look at how those two different metrics predict those kinds of outcomes that we were talking about before, like health, like educational performance and things like that, it turns out that the subjective ratings are often a better predictor than people's actual incomes. And so when the situation gets more and more unequal, larger and larger proportions of the population feel like they're low in status, even if they're not. And so the difference between people's literal bank accounts and how wealthy they feel turns out to be more important for those outcomes. And the reason is that people make decisions based not on their accounting of their bank accounts, but on how they feel at the moment. Any human faced with a decision, you know, in daily life, tends to do a gut check and go, well, how do I feel about it? And that's one reason why those subjective feelings have more of an impact in people's daily lives.
Keith Payne stays with us now. He's a professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see yourself being affected in this way by inequality? Has feeling poor ever compelled you to make bad decisions, overloaded you with stress? Do you think there is this gap between how much wealth we have or don't have and how much wealth we think we have, how wealthy we feel based on our comparisons to other people? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation now with Keith Payne, professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's got a new book out, and we're talking about that book today. It's called The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're slipping behind economically? And how does that make you feel? Have you had a point in your life where you've started making more money than you used to, and yet, even with that extra income, you still feel like you're behind, you can't get ahead? Do you have questions about how income inequality and how we feel about it affects us? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Keith, public assistance programs like welfare and food stamps, they're a hot political topic right now, pretty much always have been. How do we tend to think about whether or not those programs are a good idea based on our sense of inequality?
Well, when most people decide about whether they support or oppose those kind of programs, they look at it in one of two ways. Either consider whether the people receiving benefits are deserving or not, and that's where most people stop. And sometimes people also consider whether or not they think it will actually help people. And it's interesting that, you know, whenever people think about those who are receiving social welfare benefits of various kinds, they think about it as an individual issue, like whether a person is hardworking or not. But if we take a step back, we know that we can predict how well a child is going to do in school and how much money they're eventually going to make and things like that, before they're even born, if we know nothing about them except the zip code and or the county in which they're about to be born into. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to think about this as a purely individual issue and look at what differentiates the rich from the poor. What makes more sense, I think, is to look at the social conditions that let us predict with such accuracy that in certain counties or states, based on the level of poverty and also the level of inequality, that certain people are just not going to have a chance to do well. And you can predict that before a child is born.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Melanie joining us from Iron River. Melanie, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, you know, I think materialistically and day-to-day life, my family is very comfortable, and we certainly don't want for anything. But there is kind of a constant knowledge that one big medical bill could wipe us out, and certainly some of that feels like it's due to greed on the part of the pharmaceutical and the insurance companies, and that's really frustrating that their CEOs make so much money and we have to pay so much, and that we could get wiped out even though, you know, realistically we're doing fine.
Melanie, thank you for that. And Keith, what about maybe living with the anxiety that can come along with worrying about that next bill and also perceiving that, you know, someone else has this power over my family to make or break us?
Right. So that sense of uncertainty is another way in which people's subjective feelings have powerful effects, even if you are a comfortable middle-class family, right? So our bodies react to that sort of uncertainty, the impending possibility that there may be a threat if there is an emergency around the corner, in the same way that they react to the actual presence of a physical threat, right? So we have a stress response that responds across the whole body in very much the same way. And so at a very physical level, the uncertainty in the from being in a precarious situation, and as the caller said, being sort of one medical problem away from having a real crisis, has many of the same psychological and medical and biological effects as actually living in poverty.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Melanie. And Doug from Wisconsin Dells, really brief, please.
Sorry, just a quote that I don't remember where I got it from, but it was, poor is a condition, broke is temporary. So poverty has to do with how you believe yourself to be and never getting out of it, but you can be broke just once in a while.
Doug, thank you for that call. And Keith, what about that quote? Do you hear something in that?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. It has to do with people's expectations for the future, right? So Americans are famous for our optimism. And, you know, about a third of young adults in one recent poll said they expected to be rich one day, right? So people are very optimistic. And that's great. But one thing to keep in mind is that actual economic mobility is highly correlated with rates of inequality. And in places where the inequality is highest, social mobility is actually the lowest.
And we leave it there. Keith, thank you so much for making time to talk today.
Good to talk to you.
That was Keith Payne, professor of psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's the author of the book, The Broken Ladder, How Inequality Affects the Way We Think, Live, and Die.
The next installment of our ongoing series, State of Change, looks at drainage districts and a farmer's legal battle to protect a trout habitat in central Wisconsin. As Glenn Moberg reports, the battle over water pits environmental concerns against established agricultural practices.
Donald Justin Isherwood is a farmer, an author, and a poet. He is also now a litigant suing members of his own farm community.
The most unpleasant thing is any lawsuit.
Isherwood is suing the Portage County Drainage District over the long-standing practice of dredging ditches in order to keep fields dry for agriculture, like the 1,200 acres he farms in a region known as the Buena Vista Marsh.
Drainage and dredging, if it's not a religion, it's close by.
One of the drainage ditches, the Isherwood Lateral, runs through his property. It's filled with cold, spring-fed water and 200 Christmas trees that Isherwood put there.
Moving the stream back and forth, narrowing it up, increasing its velocity, creating some holes, exposing the gravel.
All in order to create a habitat for brook trout.
The woody material acts as cover for trout. Trout without cover simply won't stay in an area.
Isherwood says the woody material also cleans nitrates out of the water, cutting farm runoff pollution downstream.
In fact, we are not obstructing the flow, but improving it.
And as for the trout,
in the last 4 years, the numbers have gone from several dozens to thousands, if not tens of thousands, of trout at spawning season.
Justin Isherwood argues that more than a century ago, his drainage ditch was a naturally occurring stream. He got a permit from the DNR to create his fish habitat. But that's not enough, according to the chairman of the Portage County Drainage Board.
He's changed the profile of our ditch that is engineered by a professional engineer, and that's illegal. So the permit is really not valid without our blessing.
Paul Sislevich pages through a stack of oversized documents approved by the state of Wisconsin that tell him what he has to do to maintain the ditches in the 54,000-acre district.
His trout habitat is definitely going to come out, there's no doubt.
Sislevich says since 1905, the district has been protecting farmers and the regional economy.
When you have the land values of the drainage district worth probably $108 million, and that's not including the cranberry marshes, there's a lot of money here.
And the chairman argues there is already a healthy trout population in the ditches.
Ditch number 4, that's the second best trout stream in Portage County. There's never been a reclamation plan in there, nothing.
Oh,
on April 15th, Justin Isherwood hosts about 50 farmers and neighbors to convince them that more trout would be good for the economy. The guests pile onto flatbed trailers, and Isherwood hauls them past one of his 12 high-capacity wells. He says the ubiquitous wells are drawing so much groundwater that the Portage County Drainage District may no longer be necessary.
There is a legitimate debate whether drainage districts have outworn their welcome, at least in some places, simply because we want to keep the water.
When they arrive at Isherwood Lateral, the guests point to the trout they see swimming below.
It's hard to see them this time of year. Oh, there went one.
Some, like Buena Vista resident Denise Brennick, are impressed.
I'd love to see him succeed.
But others, like County Board member Matt Jakowski, are tight-lipped.
I will not comment on that. Here to observe and learn.
Justin Isherwood expects to spend $40,000 on his lawsuit. He says he is more troubled by the reaction of his neighbors.
They view me as a traitor to the cause, and from their perspective, I am.
Paul Sislevich says if Isherwood wins, it will threaten all of the drainage districts in Wisconsin.
The drainage laws are some of the oldest laws in the state of Wisconsin. We will take this as far as it needs to go to prevail.
Sislevich says unless a judge stops him, the drainage board will dredge Isherwood Lateral on July 1st. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.